So hello for the last time for this class. This is my concluding lecture, which may be longish, because I'm going to try and fit together everything from our last week of reading into one consideration, because I really think that they all together construct one single story, one single picture. So that means this lecture is going to include David Harvey, both sections, and then the last Neil Postman, and then this Naomi Klein piece about identity politics. This is the last week of class. There had been one other set of readings that I was going to include, but I didn't. But I think what we've got here makes a pretty good conclusion to the class, at least if you'll think about it in the way that I propose. I often, almost always, set up my classes in an historical format, and the reason for that is, I mean, one, it makes it easy to lay things out, but more importantly is that if we want to understand our present, looking at history gives us a way to understand that present in terms of the way that it was constructed. History puts in place different patterns of behavior, different dominant ideas, different manners of work, different technologies, different technological networks, communications networks, all kinds of networks, industrial networks, industrial relations. All those things come about incrementally through history. And really, we can talk about history in two different dimensions. If we refer back to the Marxist texts that we've looked at, all the way back to Gaventa, if not before that, and especially if you look at Althusser, then we could look at history in two different dimensions, which is what I propose to do today. You can look at history in terms of intellectual history, the history of ideas, and if you do that, then you'll start to recognize that at different places and times, different ideas are dominant, different senses of what is true or what is natural emerge and become dominant at different places. So we can look at ideological history. And under this heading, I would also include political history. Political history meaning specifically the way that decision-making and so on is carried out in specifically political forums. And then call that all ideology, as does Althusser. And then on the other hand, we can talk about a history of the infrastructure. A history of what has happened geostrategically, what has happened spatially, how it has come about that one and another interest, one and another nation controls this or that territory, controls this or that market, controls this or that labor pool. And if we focus in this way, then we're doing a kind of history of the infrastructure. So, finishing the class here is an attempt to diagram where we are now. Now, the last text here, I think, is 2005, so we're 13 years behind the present. But you can bring that up to date as you like. I think the dominant ideology that we are now faced with and the dominant mode of governance and mode of control expanded across the face of the globe, they're the same now, although ever more intense, as they were in 2005. So the simple name for this is we live in this neoliberal world. And the Harvey text that I gave you, although you would have seen only slight mention of this in the passages I selected, in Harvey, Harvey really thinks that we have to include not only the United States and Western Europe, but also Russia and China in the picture of neoliberalism. Because they are a part of the capitalist world. So I would like to leave this class by trying to make an intelligent set of suggestions about where we now are, how it comes about that we interpret American values, U.S. values, in the way that we now do. Because if you think historically, especially look at that Cruz text talking about Fifield and the National Association of Manufacturers versus the new dealers, you'll see that ideological terms, you know, things called values, they are subject to power struggles, and they can mean one thing at one point and another at another point, just if one or another party, and I don't mean political party, one or another interest has maneuvered successfully so as to reinterpret those terms. So, you know, in the New Deal period, Christian values meant social values. They meant values of reaching out to the poor, uplifting the poor, developing egalitarian communal relationships. But when the National Association of Manufacturers employs Fifield, who does the spiritual mobilization campaign, and then what we'll see today, this gets followed up, Fifield, there's like a new Fifield come the 1970s, whose name is Jerry Falwell. This whole movement succeeds in reorienting Christian values. So instead of Christian values having to do with uplifting the poor, Christian values will now have to do with upholding private property and the soul and central value of the individual. Now, those are radically different readings of Christianity. Neither of them is exactly false. They've just both taken portions of the Christian tradition and even portions of the Bible and emphasized those at the expense of the others. This is what happens when we live in any environment where there is an ideological domination. And I think that is every environment that we ever pass through. So I'm trying to get you to see a picture of how the interpretations given to American values, so-called American values, has come about and where we fit within it. That's the first portion that I want to do. Like, let's look at that history. Let's look at the history of this ideology, which I would call neoliberal ideology. And then secondly, let's look at a physical history or a history of the infrastructure through the exact same period. So basically today I'm going to draw you across the period from 1940 up to about 2010, but with special emphasis on the period from 1970 to 2005, 2010. These are two, we'll be looking at two different sets of things. They were happening at the same time, and the basic claim that Harvey makes and with which I agree is that the ideological dimension, the long set of expensive and labor-intensive battles which were engaged in by the neoconservative, neoliberal right, they served to produce a distraction to produce consent for the physical, infrastructural, economic, labor and wealth distribution changes that were happening on a more practical and infrastructural level. Ideology excuses, legitimizes, and occludes, that is, hides what's really happening in the real world. And so, of course, my concern is to convince you, and this is what Naomi Klein wants to do too, is to convince people that we need to focus on the economic dimension. We need to focus on the physical dimension, the dimension of practice, the dimension of territorial control, the dimension of economic activity and the real and even military subjugation of peoples. We need to look over there. That's where our struggles need to be. And we should not worry so much, and we should not focus so much on altering things in the dimension of what we have previously called the spectacle. So this is where I'm going to go. Okay, and you might be wondering, oh no, so he said something about neoliberalism, but I don't know what neoliberalism is exactly, though you may have heard the term, of course. Well, fear not. We're going to define neoliberalism a dozen times as we go through these two different parallel histories. We'll define neoliberalism half a dozen times or thereabouts as an ideology, because you can say there is such a thing as neoliberal ideology. And the story that we're trying to work through today is, how does neoliberal ideology become common sense? which is just another way of saying, how does neoliberal ideology become the ruling ideology of our time, to which all manner of people and institutions refer in order to justify their activities, their policy preferences, etc. So we're gonna define neoliberalism as an ideology a bunch of times. And then when we go through the second parallel history here, a history of what has happened at the level of the economy, real space, and the infrastructure, we will then define neoliberalism, I think, even more clearly. And you could go ahead and look. I mean, I made a super long set of notes for today, right? So you can go ahead and look at that history, and you'll see these long bulleted lists. And all of those lists are generalizable. They show up in the context of, like, you know, one or another set of events located historically, but they're there because they operate as basic definitions of what neoliberalism is, what neoliberalism does, how it operates, and what direction it pushes in. So this stuff will be amply defined by the time we get done. Okay. So the question is, well, okay, let me begin to introduce neoliberalism as an ideology. Perhaps the central feature of neoliberalism as an ideology is the conflation, the sticking together of the general idea of freedom, which can mean so many things, and the idea of the free market, which is much, much, much more specific. And the question is, how do we get to the situation where pretty much, for the most part, when we talk about freedom, we equate that with the free market? When we say that the United States is the freest place in the world, which is really, to tell you the truth, just nonsense, we very quickly and easily and without thought shift to saying, yes, of course, that means we have the greatest free market. Or when we pursue freedom on the global stage, when we produce freedom nominally in places like Iraq, and I mean, that's a laughable matter, really, but we've said such things. And of course, when I say we, I don't really mean we. I mean presidents and media figures and the people who pretend to speak for us and who convince us that we are them. When they talk about bringing freedom to Iraq, they really mean bringing a free market to Iraq. Somehow we've got the idea that individual liberties and unrestrained corporate behavior are the same thing. How did that happen? You could ask the same question with reference to other values too. What about individualism? So individualism is a long-standing term, a long-standing supposed value in the United States. We saw that go through at least one alteration in the history that we've looked at. There's the individualism of the frontier, and then there's the new individualism of the monopolistic giants of industry, Carnegie and Rockefeller, etc. So there's this major shift that happened between 1850 and 1900. So individualism, of course, the one thing you have to know coming out of this class is that there's not just such a thing as individualism. There's one variety of individualism and another and another and another, and whichever one becomes dominant is going to be a function of the dominant interpretations that are broadcast most effectively and with greatest saturation, etc. Well, how do we get to the point now where individualism can even be something that is supposed to apply to corporations? Because corporations are legally individuals, right? Or if you come back to actual individuals, not the fictitious ones, how do we get to the point where individualism and individual freedom seem to consist almost entirely in consumer choice? I mean, that's a pretty lame individualism. Like, I'm an individual insofar as I do the exact same shit that everybody else does, which is engage in purchasing behaviors which enrich the rich and impoverish me. How did my individualism get reduced to this? How did my freedom get reduced to freedom of consumption versus, say, freedom of production, which might have been achieved through things like unionization, or on a broader scale, on a pushier scale, socialization, etc. How do we get to the point where democracy, which arguably around the time of the American Revolution actually meant participation in town hall meetings and joint decision making about all local matters, of course, with the massive exclusion of the poor, the black, the female, but it was happening for some set of people. How do we get from a circumstance like that, where that was democracy? Democracy was expanding in the 1830s, 1840s. I mean, within limits, it was expanding to include all white men. But still, it existed for a certain group, and democracy then meant the utilization of decision-making on the part of the population in order to influence overall policy. How do we get from that to a democracy which just involves management by experts? I mean, when is the last time that you took part in deciding where a road was going to be placed, or took part in deciding what was going to be the curriculum of your children's schools? I bet you haven't done it. How do we get to the point where democratic elections consist in massive advertising campaigns designed largely emotively and through the mobilization of a great deal of racist and classist bias, advertising schemes which just produce emotional tendencies, which is going to cause me to vote for Trump instead of Clinton, or Clinton instead of Trump? How do we get to the point where democracy becomes a facade of democracy? How do we get to the present? How do we get to the neoliberal present? Okay, so let's just think in terms of ideas now. What's happening at the level of ideology, which is also the level of media? It's the level of linguistic usage. It's the level of subjectivity and how we understand ourselves. It's the level of culture. And ultimately, on the Marxist model, it also includes the level of politics. And the reason that you can call politics ideology and not infrastructural is that they suggest, and I would agree, that political happenings are at least in very large measure, if not entirely, puppeteered from by powerful forces in the background, industrial forces, institutional forces. So politics even can be a part of ideological distribution, and we're going to see that today. Okay, so let's look at history number one. How do we get to the point where freedom comes to be equated with the free market and free trade? How does neoliberal ideology, and we'll flush that out as we go along, become the dominant ideology and what most Americans take as common sense? Because, I mean, this is a big success, right, for neoliberal actors, and we'll see who they are in a moment. If a population can be compelled to have a shared, unreflected sense that it is natural for, say, wealth inequality to grow forever, that it is natural for private corporate interests to take over more and more public land, for private corporate interests to take over more and more public resources like education. If those interests can get a population to believe that that is natural and the only sane course, well, then their enterprises are exponentially easier than they would be otherwise. They might well get interrupted otherwise, but this way they won't. Okay, so let's look at the big picture. The answer that Harvey is going to give here is that the whole history we're looking at here is it moves towards a systematic justification and legitimation of a practical, infrastructural, economic neoliberal project, which is basically the reconquest of class power for financial elites. So in the 1920s, coming out of the industrialization of the late 1800s and early 1900s, there was the production of this fabulously wealthy, fabulously powerful robber baron elite. And then with the rise of the labor movement and the collapse in 1929, and then the implementation of the New Deal, the power of those classes was checked. It wasn't shut down, but it was slowed down. So neoliberalism, according to him, at the economic level, is an attempt to restore the power of these elites. So that's what is going on, and he thinks all the ideology, and they spend tons of money to produce this ideology. They use tons of intelligence and energy in order to make sure that a maximum number of Americans think that freedom and the free market and free trade are all the same thing, and that supporting corporations is how you're going to be individually free, which is, okay, let me, you know, spoiler alert, which is bullshit, but we're going to think it anyway, right? How was this sort of stuff constructed? Well, on the most general level, what has happened in the history of the United States from 1940 to really to the present is that pre-existing ideological elements, like the values that we have studied in this class, freedom, individualism, democracy, equality, although I think, I don't know where equality fits in this picture, equality is, it's gone, right? Or rather, we all have the ability to be equally impoverished as the 99%. But anyway, when constructing a new ideological system, a new dominant ideological constellation with its interpretation, the way to go about it, what happens historically, is that older values, older notions are picked up, reinterpreted, portions of them are used, portions of them are suppressed, and they're packaged up into a new bundle which retains, to significant extent, the persuasive power of those pre-existent ideological notions, because we were brought up in American schools and in American churches and in American families in these ideological state apparatuses. We've been told over and over and over that freedom is just about the best shit there is, right? And that who we are and who I am is related to freedom. So freedom is not just any other word. The title of Harvey's chapter is, you know, implying freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose, right? Anyway, freedom's got a force to it. That notion has a force to it. And what happens in this period that we're looking at is that idea, which is underdetermined, because like we know we're supposed to be all for freedom, but we don't necessarily know what that means, right? We think we're super free, but somehow we're also wiretapped in every aspect of our life. We think we're free, but most of us don't have the money to go very far. We think we're free, but of course we could be shot on the street. We think we're free. I'm not just saying that we are a totally unfree society. That would require, first of all, that I had established what freedom means. My point is rather that we don't necessarily know what freedom means. It can mean any number of things. And part of the ideological battle that happens with every generation is a battle to determine what these key terms are going to mean. Okay, so this is the big picture. More specifically, the answer to how this happens is, as I have mentioned, through ideological state apparatuses, through internal corporate culture, through internal police culture, through the media, through universities, through primary and secondary schools, through churches, through professional associations. These are the places where ideological doctrine indoctrination and ideological conflict are worked out. So part of what allowed neoliberalism to become the dominant ideology of today was intentional conquests of churches, intentional conquests of the media, intentional conquests, at least of significant positions within the universities. This is not just an accidental process. Like, the more concrete we become in looking at how values have been distributed and how they have been reinterpreted for us, we'll see more and more conscious strategies for advancing one versus another interpretation of an ideological notion. Maybe here's a definition for what neoliberalism as ideology is. Number one, the end point, where we're at now, the stuff that we hear quite a lot, is that the era of the New Deal, of World War II, and then the period that Harvey refers to as embedded liberalism, the 1940s through the 1960s, a period during which there was a certain compromise between labor groups, social solidarity groups on the one hand, and businesses on the other, the welfare state, the minimum wage, all these protections that were established by the New Deal were still strongly in place. Embedded liberalism means that business activity, corporate enterprise, was encumbered with a whole lot of regulations. So the neoliberal line and the neoliberal movement from 1970 on is about getting rid of that stuff. The neoliberal line says that, hey, look, human dignity and individual freedom are challenged by a situation where the state is so great that it can impose all of these regulations. Now, notice the shift has already happened there, because the regulations were not imposed on individuals. They were imposed upon businesses, right? So how is it that human dignity and individual freedom are challenged by the regulation of business activity? That is not explained. It's a trick. This is rhetoric, right? And what is it that individual freedom and human dignity are challenged by? Well, it's not just the regulatory apparatus. If you want to put it in the strongest terms, all that stuff tends towards fascism, dictatorship, communism, state power. So neoliberal discourse opposes itself to state power. And one of the things that Harvey will want to say, and that I'll say before I'm done, is that neoliberal ideology is a lie in a whole bunch of different ways. Because my freedom really, it does not coincide at all with the freedom of corporations, nor does yours. But also it's a lie in that actual neoliberal practice doesn't really line up with the broad contours of neoliberal ideology. So if neoliberal ideology is in large measure, it's in opposition to the state. And so libertarians and libertarian ideology is a subset of neoliberal ideology. Supposedly, all these proponents of neoliberalism are opposed to the state altogether, but that's not really true because, and this was already present in Adam Smith, who the neoliberals really like, the state still has to, according to them, provide the conditions for a good business environment. That means counterinsurgency, heavy policing, suppression of opposition, definite destruction of any socialistic or nationalizing movements. The state has to inhibit the growth of labor unions. The state has to safeguard private property. So what they say and what they do are not necessarily the same. Okay, so let's look at this history. Let's start with the 1950s. And let's recall, first of all, what we saw in the Kevin Kruse book about the rise of the Christian right. And I think Kruse has done some research that Harvey himself is not aware of. So Harvey speaks as if the preparation of the Christian right was begun around 1978 with Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority, which was a huge television-based, large-scale Christian fundamentalist movement. But we know from this reading that it started earlier than that, right? So in the 1950s, the National Association of Manufacturers, who were in this predicament because the ideology coming out of labor unions, the remaining echoes of the ideology of the New Deal, and the fact of the financial crash of 1929 and the depression that followed it, had put business and private enterprise into some ideological disrepute. People were skeptical about whether business was good for them and whether business should be let to do as it wished. And so business felt this pinch in various ways, and it definitely felt it in terms of the regulations that were imposed upon it. Environmental regulations, regulations with respect to labor, minimum wages, healthcare, all the rest. So they wanted to change public opinion so as to have a foothold in this nominally democratic society to push back against those regulations. They wanted a free hand to do as they wanted to do. How did they go about that? Well, if you recall, and if you don't recall, go check out this lecture or go do this reading again, because as you know, coming now to the end of the class, I think that piece is like fairly central. What did they do? They carried out the spiritual mobilization campaign where they lined up tens and then hundreds of thousands of clergy across the United States. They started feeding them literary material to be distributed in and to their churches. They built the beginnings of a business-friendly Christianity, which was a large reversal from the period of the New Deal, when a whole bunch of Christian organizations had been allied with the socialist leaning, or apparently socialist leaning, with the compromising government. So this was beginning to reverse that, and they did it on the basis of a certain crowd of people, because they could access that ISA, the church. Fifield figured out how to do that. And then they did these publications, and they did radio shows, and they did television, and they linked up with Disney, right? This is all this movement. They also, like, their publications drew upon some of the key figures of neoliberalism. Friedrich von Hayek, who had said that the battle for ideas was a key thing, and he also pointed towards academia and the university as a battlefield where common sense could be produced in favor or opposed to one or another party. The economist Ludwig von Mises, the philosopher Karl Popper, the economist Milton Friedman, who's maybe the most important figure in this whole neoliberal story, really, because he's the people who teaches, he's the dude who teaches the Chicago boys who alter the economy of much of South America in league with dictators in the 1960s and the 1970s. So these are all of a group called the Mont Pelerin Society. And they start advancing, and anybody who uses them advances. So we're like looking at the construction of a bunch of different elements of an ideology that get synthesized and resynthesized in generation after generation of production. And the production could be the production of a text, of a book, of a TV show, of a radio show, of a political party's platform, etc. So what was central to the messaging of the Mont Pelerin Society, which offered itself as authoritative and expert on issues of economy? They said the central values of civilization are in danger. Human dignity and freedom have disappeared. And this has happened because of a denial of absolute moral standards and a decline in belief in private property in the competitive market. There you can see like a lot of stuff pulled together, right? This is connected again to the appeal of neoliberalism to the right. The idea that a certain population or a certain demographic is in possession of absolute moral standards and everybody else sucks and the society sucks because they fail to recognize what's fucking right and what's fucking wrong. Of course, it was not fucking right for me to fucking say fucking, so I'm a part of the problem, right? I lack absolute moral standards. And a real strong Christian right person would be truly offended at what I just said, right? Like, there's a sense within Christian communities and within religious communities and conservative communities, perhaps, in general, that they possess a knowledge of moral standards that other people lack. Okay, so this group of writers, who you could also think of as propagandists, then take that relationship to morality and they put it together with a much more specific selection: private property in the competitive market. So they've given their Christian right base, and anybody else who will listen, their mass audience, they've given them an interpretation of what are central to these alleged absolute moral values that everybody's supposed to know about. Private property and the competitive market are offered as if they were equivalent to, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you or something. They also resuscitate Adam Smith, who was the first famous proponent of capitalism and the free market. And he had offered the idea of the invisible hand. Basically, he says, you know, in a capitalist system, all the actors act selfishly. They just act for themselves. And yet, it is as if they were led by an invisible hand to produce the common good. So the claim was that, yes, market systems, free market economies, facilitate and nurture greedy behavior, which looks like it could well be opposed to the interests of the majority of the population, the common interest. And yet, just because markets are so cool and they self-adjust, this is according to Smith, and then this is part of the ideology that's being reborn and redistributed in the 1970s and onward, it just turns out that markets produce the maximum good for everybody. They're utilitarian good. So they take this old stuff and they put it back together, and then they link it together with absolute morality, and among other people, they hand it to the Christian right. But it's not only that ISA that they're shooting for, or that they're trying to operate through, and it's not only the universities. They also set up new institutions specifically for the distribution of ideas. And if you go back and look at Noam Chomsky, who was writing in, I think, what was that text, 1984 maybe? He says, you know, one of the filters that mass media dominant content has to get through is what he calls flack. If I gave you more of the book to look at, or if you went and read it, the book is called Manufacturing Consent, you'd see that the flack that he's talking about is what comes from think tanks. So think tanks are groups of intellectuals, researchers, speakers, propagandists, who are lined up on some particular side and almost entirely on the pro-business side because they are funded by business. So you can talk about conservative think tanks and liberal think tanks, but the liberal think tanks are still funded by business for the most part. And even if they're not, like, liberal does not mean radical, does not mean oppositional. So mostly if you think about think tanks, you're thinking about business-funded collections of ideologists whose job it is to produce and distribute ideas that legitimize whatever path business itself wants to take. And also the flack that Chomsky was talking about, and also that will respond to any kind of ideological production and distribution which challenges that legitimation. So the mass media has to deal with the blowback they're going to get from these massively funded think tanks should they stray too far away from the corporate line. So among these think tanks that are formed in the late 1960s, early 1970s, the Heritage Foundation, which you've probably heard of, the Hoover Institute, the Center for the Study of American Business, the American Enterprise Institute, which is really important, and then these combine together into the National Board of Economic Research. And they do produce scientific, technical, and empirical reports, right? So they're providing an aura of scientific legitimacy, especially economic-scientific legitimacy for whatever practices it is that the corporations already know they want to pursue. And just because they're empirical and scientific, by the way, doesn't mean that they're true. Doesn't mean that they're not selective. In fact, every scientific study is selective. It chooses certain questions. It chooses certain methods. It chooses certain methods for data acquisition. It chooses certain methods for data analysis. And it very strategically, especially when we're talking about this kind of science, which is, this is kind of equivalent to the kind of science that, say, like, you know, people at a pharmaceutical company do, or like at a tobacco company do, in order to show that tobacco smoking is not so linked to lung cancer. you know, the kind of stuff that they did for decades, or the kind of shit that people like, you know, Monsanto do now to try and show, you know, there's no demonstration that our fertilizers, pesticides, etc., that they cause any kind of problem to human bodies. Those are, they're lies, right? But they're lies that are grounded in empirical research. How is that possible? That sounds like a contradiction. Well, it's possible because you can choose exactly which research you're going to reference and which ones you're not. You set up your conclusions beforehand, and you figure out what is the means by which empirically and analytically to support that conclusion. The conclusion becomes before the research, and the research is aiming to support the conclusion. Okay, so think tanks. And then by the 1970s and 1980s, this ideology is being pushed into center stage of the Republican Party. And manufacturing concerns, or rather, by this point, we're not really talking about manufacturing exclusively. Even manufacturers, like, say, automobile manufacturers, by the 1980s have become increasingly financial entities. They engage in credit schemes, right? They finance your car for you. They offer you roadside assistance plans. They take their profits and they invest them in the futures market. So by the late 1970s, early 1980s, we're really talking about a bunch of corporate players, all of whom are like financial capitalists. By, say, 1980, that interest, the collection of finance capitalists who are really working increasingly as a block through these think tanks and by other means, they capture, to use Harvey's term, the Republican Party. And they do that by means, first of all, of political action committees. So political action committees, the statistic that Harvey gives is that in 1974, there are only 89 of those. 8 years later, in 1982, there are 1,467 political action committees. So this is a way for the business sector, finance capital, to consolidate its force and to inject that force into politics, into the selection of political personnel, into the determination and the influencing over political messaging. So by means of the political action committees, first of all, I mean, and this stuff is like happening in waves, right? Because I think I've talked in previous lectures about the Koch brothers and Citizens United. Citizens United, which is like a super lying title. It has nothing to do with citizens. That was a more recent legislation that super raised the amount of money that corporations were able to inject into politics and therefore the amount of control that they could exert. Well, one of the first things that happened in the 1970s was that political action committees were used in order to raise the amount of influence that because they had a little bit of influence, they used that influence to take steps in order to increase the amount of their influence. So 1976, corporate political contributions get legally declared freedom of speech as a result of the lobbying carried out on the basis of corporate political contributions. What else? In the 1970s, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is another place where this struggle is happening. They expand from 60,000 to 250,000 or more firms working together. And they're also working together with the National Association of Manufacturers. And they're putting together what are basically propaganda campaigns aimed at universities, schools. 1978, Jerry Falwell. So there's this new, now we looked at Fifield and the spiritual mobilization movement. Here's the next generation, the moral majority. I mean, this is a large social movement, I suppose you could call it, but it's largely based in the spectacle. It's based on television, and Falwell is this, like, you know, TV preacher who consolidates a Christian fundamentalist right and preaches free market ideology. So here's another stage where we can identify or define what neoliberalism is as an ideology. What is it that Falwell was broadcasting to his viewership? The idea that freedom and the free market and free trade are all the same thing. But he also utilized a whole lot of pre-existent racist and sexist cultural predispositions of the white working class. So this is about taking those divisions that had existed all the way since the time of slavery, those complicated divisions, right? Because, you know, even post-slavery in the Jim Crow South, violence, you know, according to C.L.R. James, violence against black folks also served to suppress poor white folks because it made it impossible to organize labor. But at the same time, there were certain ways in which the apartheid system that existed at that time and all the way up through the 1950s, it benefited whites disproportionately from blacks. So there was this divide between whites and blacks, which is preyed upon here. And there's this fear that corresponds to that. And we talked about that from the beginning of the class, right? The fear of black folks, which originates with the subjugation of black folks. Maybe even the fear of women, which begins with the subjugation of women. These fears translate into hatreds, and those hatreds can be seized upon and utilized. So Falwell is a homophobic, sexist, racist, Christian asshole. Pardon me if you love Jerry Falwell. You know, I'm also engaged in ideological construction over here, right? I'm interpreting things for you. But I doubt that anybody could deny that Falwell used racism, homophobia, and anti-feminism in order to consolidate a sort of block of opinion within this newly reformed Christian fundamentalist right. And now we get the neoliberal idea, the right conservative idea, that the problem is liberals. And liberals have immoral lifestyles. And what liberals have done is to use so-called excessive state power in order to better these special interest groups, blacks, women, environmentalists, right? So this is ideology that we're talking about now. It's not so much a question of whether that's true or not. It's a question of, how does that operate, and what goals does it serve? What ends does it ultimately serve? And the end that it ultimately serves is the end of corporate power being able to do whatever the hell it wants. And what it wants is to increase indefinitely social inequality, and thus to produce at a greater and greater level the exceptional power of a very small ruling elite. This is Harvey's claim. Okay, the 1980s, we have books like Michael Nozick's book, State Anarchy something, which is not really about anarchism. It's about the free market. TV shows, even one involving Milton Friedman called Free to Choose. And then the last thing to look at here is that there's a kind of just terrible mistake that happens, and here I'm leaning towards Naomi Klein, that happens on the part of opponents to this corporate takeover. They mess up, and the way in which they mess up is that they get smitten by the spectacle, and they start. So we get identity politics and postmodernism in the university in the 1980s and the 1990s, and this spreads quite broadly. And Naomi Klein talks about this, she, as someone who was involved in it, that they were super involved in the question of whether historically oppressed and under-recognized and politically disadvantaged groups like black people and Latino people and Asian people and Jewish people and lesbians and gays and etc. were represented properly in media, in the world of representation, in television and in print. That was their concern. And you can see on the basis of our class why that matters. It matters to a degree, right? Because the images of people that are distributed through the media operate as models for identification for all of us, and especially for the young, we take those models and we imitate them. We see ourselves in them. And so if every time that a black person shows up in a movie, they look stupid and servile, that's got a psychological effect upon black folks and especially black kids who see it. And we've gone over this problem also when we looked at the distribution of Disney to the colonized world. So these are real problems, right? But the problem here was that by focusing entirely upon the domain of representation, Klein says that opposition to corporate power in the 1980s and the 1990s missed where power was really happening, which was at the economic level, at the level of ownership, at the level of territorial control, control over bodies. And well, since I'm talking about her, I might as well just skip ahead and cover her a little bit. I think there's maybe just one thing to add to that, was that she says her generation realized their mistake when they found out that corporations actually didn't mind all this diversity stuff at all. They loved it, in fact. And they were totally willing to put gay characters and black characters and disabled characters and whoever else had been underprivileged in the real world, put them into advertising campaigns and sitcoms and so on, even in at least nominally positive ways. And definitely advertising campaigns proceeded to represent all these different groups in positive ways. Why did they do that? Did they do it because I'm just wrong all the way through this class and corporations really have a conscience? No, I don't think so. She doesn't think so. The real reason is that these were markets that had previously been untapped. You can get more black folks to buy your stuff if you represent black folks in your advertising. You can get more gay, especially the gay world, coming into representation in the continuum that we have called the spectacle. That opened up way more purchasing power than people had previously recognized. And by insisting upon diversity, insisting upon the representation of all these different types of people, there were all kinds of more goods that could be sold. So she says, you know, like people went into gay bars with hidden cameras working for marketing firms in order to, you know, check out like what were the trends, what was the fashion, what were the drinks, you know, what was the music, what's the culture like, so that that culture could be represented in the media, so that that portion of humanity could see themselves and pump their money into the corporations. Instead of identity politics challenging the system, she says, identity politics actually fed the system. Meanwhile, the Democratic Party has been split through this whole process because it was more firmly rooted in oppositional New Deal era portions of the American world, the labor movements in particular, and had a constituency of poorer people going into the 1970s and 1980s. And it wasn't able to adjust very quickly. And the other thing was it was completely beholden itself to corporate dollars and corporate influence. So the Democratic Party is no obstacle to the Republican Party. So the Republican Party becomes dominant. The Democratic Party doesn't offer much resistance to it. And the so-called left, operating primarily in this forum of identity politics, which really has forgotten about class and economics and territory and the militants of the 1960s, that all that stuff was gone. There's no streets in identity politics. All of these things allow the ideological takeover of universities, media, church, etc., by neoliberal ideology. That gets us up to the present. There's one other thing going on here, perhaps, which Neil Postman talks about, which is also an effect of immersion within spectacular society, immersion within a visual society where there are multiple channels of information and truth and positions going on all the time. What Postman, who is a bit of a stodgy dude, if you ask me, based on his writing, but what he suggests, I think, is worth considering, and that is that he thought in an earlier period, like say in the 1800s, say in this like period of the heyday of American democracy, Jacksonian democracy, America, the United States, was a literary culture. Now, we already looked at how there were ideological mechanisms, I mean, school books and all this kind of stuff. But the general argument that Postman makes, is that as a reading culture, there are still certain rational principles which are dominant. So I read, like, you know, one set of opinions over here on page 3 of the newspaper and another set over here on page 6, and I sort of compare and contrast them, and I think, well, okay, this one contradicts here, this one contradicts himself, so that can't be any good. I'm continually trying to synthesize each of the statements that I read into an overall unified worldview, which is not necessarily right, but it constitutes my opinion. And that should be an informed opinion. And this is the word opinion used in the way that Postman thinks we should use it. What all this rests upon is a drive for unity and an insistence upon the principle of non-contradiction, which is a foundational rule for logic. You can't have reasoning without the principle of non-contradiction, which says something can't be both true and false at the same time, in the same way, at the same place. You know, Donald Trump can't be both a good guy who is going to save America and like a spluttering racist fool with his finger on the nuclear button who might kill us all. And yet many of us are capable of entertaining those two contradictory concepts at the same time. Postman says it's the result of the media environment by which we are surrounded. Fast forward from 1850 to 1950 with the domination of television and movies, and then move forward from there and the domination of marketers and advertising and applied psychologists who have figured out how to use the perpetual flow of visual material in order to integrate desires and activities and behaviors, especially spending behaviors, into corporate America. Fast forward to that point and start to realize, well, maybe the principle of non-contradiction is breaking down, because instead of, you know, saying, okay, page 3 and page 6 are a part of the same world and one of them's got to be, you know, they got to fit together somehow. Instead of doing that, as we multiply channels, as we multiply flows of information and positions and alleged truths and facts, perhaps we just let go of these two things, the desire to unify the whole thing and say, you know what, there's got to be some truth out there. And even if I don't know what it is, putting all this shit together, my best guess is X. Maybe we've dropped that tendency because the world is too chaotic. The flows of information are too many. But maybe then we also drop the principle of non-contradiction and we start believing that things can be both one way and another way. Yeah, the United States is a neo-imperial power with nuclear capacity to destroy the whole globe, that is consuming most of the resources of the globe and is destroying brown people all over the earth and has been doing that since the beginning of its existence. But on the other hand, the United States is the best country in the world, and it's the freest country in the world, and it's got the only system that really works for the world. Those are contradictory statements. But I think a whole lot of Americans are perfectly capable of believing them both. And Postman's reasoning for that is, like, it's just because they basically feel like, you know, one thing is true on channel 4 and another thing is true on channel 7. You know, one thing is true on CNN and another thing is true on Fox. One thing is true if you hear this expert, another thing is true if you hear that expert. There are multiple positions, and we seem to have lost the impulse to determine for real which one of those positions is more likely, which ones we're going to put our bets on. So he says, you know, instead of opinions, what really gets generated in us is emotions. And those emotions can be changed by the flow of this spectacular system, hour to hour, day to day, week to week, no problem. He specifically got it in for the news, right? So like the nature of the whole world around us is given to us by the news, but the news is entertainment. You know, the news has like a soundtrack. The news has like cool graphics. The news has good looking anchors who have to look in a certain way or else they'll get fired. And based on the way that the news is presented, we're more or less likely to believe it. Like if I show you CNN talking about something, I bet you're going to be more likely to believe that it's real than if I show you one of the sort of YouTube-based, like, you know, private news feeds. It's not necessarily the case that it is, but it looks better, right? And so we tend to conflate appearance with reality. We tend to confuse slick presentation with believability. And then there's also the fact that, like, the channels are flipping all the time. There's so many different flows going on. And even within a newscast, you get, what, like 2 minutes, 1 minute, 30 seconds on one item, and then you go to the next, and then you go to the next, and then you go to the next. What's excluded in that? Every single context. So we don't get an understanding of context. We don't have real knowledge of the shit that shows up in the news, but because it shows up in the news and we are able to repeat it, we feel like we know it. So the overall position here is that as this power play is happening, and that's what we're going to look at in 1 minute, as the real takeover by corporations and the real neoliberal move and the real dramatic increase in wealth inequality and all that sort of stuff is going on, the populace of the world, and especially the populace of the United States, is increasingly sucked up in images. It can't relate to anything except images. The spectacle has made people fundamentally passive. It has made us be fundamentally spectators. Our continual integration with our screens has disintegrated the social fabric. So we've lost our social solidarity and the power that goes along with combined action. But we're also losing our sense of what's true or the capacity for things to be true. We're losing our rationality. We're losing our ability to inquire into contexts. We're losing our curiosity. And probably neoliberal education is in part to blame for this stuff, because I feel like so many students are utterly alienated from education. And I believe that there's like a, I hate to say natural, because obviously that's got an ideological dimension, but I'll say it anyway, a natural tendency to be curious on the part of human beings. Well, by the time they get to my class, most of that shit seems to have been beat out of them, because students just sit there staring, right? I don't think that's like some personal failure on the part of students. I think that is a systemic effect on the part of this world that we live in. Questioning has been shut down. And if you go so far as Postman, maybe even the capacity to reason has been broken down. So we have a more and more pliable, more and more pliant, more and more subjugated populace. Okay, so now let's move to the second historical sequence here, which is the sequence of like what actually happens physically, economically, spatially, militarily through this same period that we just covered. And here we'll start a little bit earlier. Start with the 1920s up to 2005, 2010. Now, what's the general big picture for Harvey? Harvey's like, okay, supposedly neoliberalism was advancing freedom. That's their rhetoric, right? But what's really happening is the advance of the interests of private property, businesses, multinational corporations, finance capital, which are really all the same thing. It's the advancement of a certain elite, a certain class of owners, which is getting smaller and smaller, but more and more powerful. Neoliberalism, he says, is a strategy for the reconstruction and augmentation of class power. That is the reconstruction of the power of an ultra-elite rich. Why does he say reconstruction? Because he thinks that something like that existed about 100 years ago in the United States in the time of Rockefeller and Carnegie, etc. Like, not since then had there been the kind of wealth disparity, which again became prominent by the 2000s. So a reconstruction of class power. So it's the distance between the lower class and the upper class, economically, but also politically, in terms of decision-making, in just about according to any standard, there's a greater and greater divide between us and them. And that could roughly be the 99% and the 1%, if you want. Okay, so let's look at this history. Start with the 1920s to the 1930s. Neo-imperialist policies on the part of the United States are an indispensable portion of the expansion of neoliberalism across the face of the globe. Primarily, that form of contemporary capitalism gets started in the post-war era and really just accelerates from 1970 onward. But the type of territorial control and control over weaker nation states and their populations that would be necessary in order for that expansion to happen on a global basis and truly to globalize after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1989-1990 was through American so-called neo-colonialism. Now, neo or neo-imperialism. So old-style imperialism or colonialism meant the placing of troops in some subjugated territory, right? If it's colonialism, then the settling of colonial people on the land belonging previously to somebody else. But the neo-imperialist and neo-colonial strategy involves doing this by means of proxies. So Harvey's example is Nicaragua. So what do you do in order to control a territory without committing yourself in this way, without risking your troops, without making it super obvious in the dawning spectacle all these flows of representation embracing all of us at this point in time, without making it too obvious what we're actually up to? Well, you find a local strongman in whatever territory it is, and you provide that person and his cronies, his family, his immediate network, with economic and military assistance. And these two things, money and guns, allow that person and his network to repress, kill, imprison their opponents, or to buy them off. Guns to repress, money to buy off. And what this dude is getting rich, and he's in power, and so are his people, and they're happy about it. They are a very small minority of the population. The population is living under decidedly non-democratic conditions. What does he do in return for the favor that the U.S. has done to him? He keeps his country open to U.S. capital. And he promotes U.S. interests domestically by making sure that markets are open to U.S. products and resources are open to U.S. or other multinational interests, and even regionally. So in the case of Nicaragua, we're going to influence the rest of Central America through there. Same thing happens in Iran in 1953. There's a socialist personality by the name of Mohammad Mossadegh, who was very popular, democratically elected, moved to nationalize resources in Iran, specifically oil. And what happened to him? The CIA plotted a coup to push him out of power and imprison him. And they put in his place this dude called the Shah. And how do they keep the Shah in power? They give him guns and money. And specifically, they help him set up a secret police force, a CIA-trained police force called SAVAK, which is brutal, which disappears all kinds of people, which engages in direct repression, which has extensive regimes of torture. This is what the CIA, this is what your country does globally. These are facts. And it's that rule of the Shah. And then, of course, he does all the things that the United States and Northern Capital want him to do. He keeps the resources open. He keeps the markets open. He westernizes. He commodifies. It's that context, the cultural imperialism that he facilitated, together with the true state repression, the regimes of torture that were carried out by his secret police force with CIA and probably also Mossad. That's the Israeli secret service force. That's the context that produces the Islamic Revolution in Iran of 1979. This kind of thing is true across the board. Like, before you just go believing the old story that you're always told that, like, oh, Islam hates us, Iranians are tribal and backwards, and therefore they go for this, like, antiquated religious crap because, and there's, what is this guy, Benjamin, what's his name? I can't remember. He wrote a book called Jihad versus McWorld, which is, like, kind of a bestseller in He said things like, well, you know, the Iranian people are just, they're backwards. They can't get with modernity because, like, their culture is just, like, kind of busted and stupid. Like, that's all lies. It's all lies. There was a ground for a need for a revolution in Iran, and that ground was prepared by the United States. Okay, so the history that we're looking at on an economic level starts in the 1940s and the 1960s, where we have this period of so-called embedded liberalism, where corporate and business power is subjected to a good amount of regulation, and where the dominant economic theory has a different goal than the dominant economic theory coming out of Milton Friedman, and which is dominant today. And that goal was not just the maximization of profit or the allowance of markets to operate without regulation, which is what Friedman and them really like. Instead, Keynesian economics was oriented towards full employment and citizen welfare. And it was really trying to build a sort of hybrid system. Now, arguably, this is not really possible. From like a hard left view, you'd say, well, okay, capitalism is going to eventually wreck all such systems. And this is what happens historically in this case. But they wanted to form a kind of like uneasy balance between capital interests and the interests of, if not everyday people, then at least the associations more closely connected with everyday people, like trade unions. And they also wanted to compensate for and defend against some of the tendencies of an unencumbered capitalist economy, especially things like financial crisis and speculative bubbles, which is the kind of thing that crashed the economy in 1929, again around the savings and loan scandal, again in 2008 with real estate and debt speculation. They wanted to check those things, right? So Keynesian economics has to do with dampening the so-called business cycle. That's the context which corporate capital, which is redundant, the circumstances that corporations wanted to get themselves out of, right? Now, they didn't need to get out immediately. They started moving as early as the 1950s. We saw with James Fifield and spiritual mobilization, right? They wanted to be unencumbered, but it wasn't so pressing for them because they continued the rate of capital accumulation continued to be solid for them. They made lots of money through the 1950s and the 1960s. For one thing, they were saturating markets domestically. This is something Harvey doesn't talk about, but it's a little feature that was going on. You know, not every American household had a TV, or not every American room had a TV, and not every American household had like a car or had two cars in, say, 1948. But by 1965, that pretty much was done, right? So they saturated those markets. They continued to exploit the third world. So the third world was not really benefited by this this deal. But by the 1970s, for one reason and another, and really for a whole bunch of reasons, there's a crisis of so-called capital accumulation, meaning they can't make enough money anymore. And as corporations start making less money, then the tax revenues of states and cities is going down. And this is weakening their ability to cover social programs, etc. So we're moving towards a situation where there's a problem. 1970s, we start to see deindustrialization. The corporations started to recognize that, we just need to take our manufacturing outside this country, because here in Detroit, for example, there are unions which are going to cause, which are going to prevent us maximizing our profit. Now, profit had been good for a couple of decades, and, you know, especially in a place like Detroit, you know, that was the place where black people in America lived better than they ever had before. The only precedent before that really being like Harlem, 1920s or so, the Harlem Renaissance. But this is much, you know, much higher, like it's just as far as like economic standards of living went. So there's this period of relative prosperity in the United States from 1950 to 1960. And of course, the military industrial complex is growing, and we have McCarthyism in that period. It's not actually nice. We have lynchings and racial violence, and then we have the civil rights movement. You could also look at the rise of neoliberalism as the counter-revolution to the revolution of the 1960s. And that's true in a lot of ways, too. A lot of the gains that are made in terms of civil rights, et cetera, in the 1960s will be reversed from the 1970s onward. Anyway, so deindustrialization starts leaving cities like Detroit just devastated. And as manufacturing is pulled out of a place, well, then the general power of organized labor is backed off too. The general power of it to influence political policy, educational policy, social policy is backed off. 1973 is an important year for our purposes because it starts to set up the financial regularities, but also the military foothold, the military posture that will be dominant probably right up to the present. Militarily, what happens in 1973 is that there's the Arab-Israeli war, which feeds into the OPEC oil crisis, the OPEC embargo. They refused to sell oil to the U.S. Prices went up and up and up and up. And the U.S., Harvey tells us, threatened to invade Saudi Arabia. And so they force Saudi Arabia into a deal. But it's not really clear in the long run who the deal really benefited most. The deal was that within OPEC, Saudi Arabia was going to prevent embargoes from happening and was going to control the price of oil for us. And they were going to feed, and I say us, I don't really mean us. I mean for export. And especially for corporations. But they're also, they agreed to put all of their earnings, their massive billions and billions and trillions of dollars of earnings, into New York investment banks. So all of a sudden, New York investment banks have all this money to play with. And of course, what a bank does with money is make more money. What Saudi Arabia got in return was military support from the United States. So we propped up yet another authoritarian regime because of its geostrategic usefulness and its economic usefulness. And then what happens with the money that is into these investment banks is that this moves towards like the next stage of financial policy on the global stage, which is that there's so much money in these investment banks that there's not enough investment opportunity domestically for them to use it. They export that capital, but they don't just export it in the way that, like, so I mean, like Lenin wrote about this in 1917, 1918 in his book Imperialism. And he said, you know, like that happens in colonialism. Part of colonialism happens because there's not enough, there's no way to capitalize on capital. There's no way to make more money out of the money that you've got in a super industrialized, developed world, like, you know, Germany 1914 or England 1914 or even 1900 or 1890, which is the period of greatest colonial activity. And so what did they do? They took over colonial territories and they invested in enterprises there. So we've got the same thing happening here again, but with a much more specific strategy. So now it's loans. It's loans that are being made. So this is like a neo-colonial strategy. It's loans that are being made to impoverished, so-called developing countries. And usually, increasingly, these loans are coming from the World Bank, which, as I understand it, is a sort of consortium of other banks or a clearinghouse for them. And then the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, is the sort of broker which sets up these deals. So they loan money, for example, to Mexico. But then, either by accident or by intent, depending on the circumstance, if and when those debtor countries renege, we're going to force them to pay. One good thing about lending, you can read this book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which talks about this. You know, one of the benefits of lending to a nation state is a nation state can't, like, run away. Instead of forgiving debt, what the IMF tends to do, or what big banks tend to do through the IMF, is to demand certain concessions on the part of
debtor countries, in order for them to get more money to pay off their previous loans or to roll back some of the loans that they had before. And this is like a systematic strategy from the 1970s onward, especially 1982 with Mexico, right up to the present. The IMF demands so-called structural adjustment and austerity programs, which means that they use an economic lever in order to open the markets, open the resources, open the labor supplies, open the previously public resources to private investment. And all that is like a really good definition of what neoliberalism is at the economic and territorial level. And then they demand austerity measures, which just means that people have to live worse. People have to suck it up. They have to take lower pay. They have to have crappier schools. Their subsidized housing gets taken away from them. So basically, the population is made to pay for the loan that the government took. Okay, so here are some key landmark cases in the development of global neoliberalism. 1973. The coup in Chile, which we looked at last week, because that was the context in which the Dorfman and Matalart book was burned. So Allende, Salvador Allende, in 1970 had been elected and was a part of a large-scale social movement with all kinds of organization existing within the social fabric of that country, trade unions, militant student groups, peasant groups, large-scale organization demanding basically a socialization of the economy, the take back of resources from multinational corporations, the nationalization of mines, that kind of stuff. So, which is generally speaking what the revolutions of the 20th century were largely about, at least the latter half of the 20th century, like getting back the shit that colonialism stole. That's what nationalization is about. And though you've been told ideologically that communism is itself a kind of like evil virus, and I wouldn't deny that the Soviet Union was also an entity seeking greater and greater territorial control and making people unhappy and robbing their shit. That's true. But socialism is basically just the idea that a people's resources and a people's labor should be used for the benefit of those people. So this is what Allende is trying to do. And so his opponents, like the small elite of Chileans in the business sector who had already worked out their deals with multinational corporations in the distance, another way of putting that would be who had already sold out their nation's resources and markets to foreigners, but they got paid off for it. They worked together with the CIA, which was primarily the entity behind this whole thing, and then Henry Kissinger and his State Department, in order to back this general, Augusto Pinochet, who then led a military coup in which Allende died. Anyway, you can check out this documentary from last week to see what that was, right? So what did this involve? Well, it involved, first of all, the violent repression of social movements, and then the dismantling of all the different forms of popular organization, community health centers, professional associations, trade unions, etc. And then Pinochet, because Pinochet is not really in charge, because the corporations of the First World are really in the background, and the corporations and the CIA are supporting this dictatorial regime, which is throwing bodies into the ocean, maybe not into the ocean, which is dropping people out of helicopters, which is torturing extensively. I mean, this is the regular team. So the next time you go to tell somebody about how great the United States is and how free market is the only thing, I would urge you to just, pause. Just pause. Think for a minute. Because Pinochet is not himself in, the only one in charge, he takes on board into his government a whole bunch of people that were trained by Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago who were free market fundamentalists, and he lets them just have free reign to do whatever they want to Chile. So what do they do? I mean, here's like your first really good long list of what neoliberalism is, or what it does at the infrastructural level. They reversed all the nationalizations. They privatized an increasing amount of public assets. They opened up all natural resources to private, unregulated exploitation. And this meant like the total devastation of many indigenous communities. They privatized Social Security. They allowed foreign direct investment, which under the title of free trade. But they also like legalized those corporations taking all the money that they made out of Chile back out of Chile. So they're just taking the Chilean resources and turning them into the resources of one or another mining concern from the United States or Scandinavia or you know, Northern Europe or whatever. And then they kind of reconfigure the economy for export-led development. That means that the whole country is going to be dependent upon imports. And that's important because they want to make the whole country a market for corporations. So everything that is done is for the global neoliberal order, which is dominated by corporations. 1975, very similar thing happens in New York City. Here's another example that Harvey gives. New York City had been severely impacted by deindustrialization, by the move of manufacturing out of the first world and into the third world. So there was there's tremendous drop in tax revenues, tremendous increase in employment. In unemployment. And with that lessened tax revenue, it was hard for New York City to cover all of its social programs. So Citibank forces New York City into bankruptcy. And then the banks bail out New York City, but they do it on condition of structural adjustment of New York City. So they want banks themselves or their representatives to have more managerial control, especially over the city budget. They get access to first claim on tax revenues. By the way, this is the context in which Donald Trump is becoming a tremendously successful businessman. They impose austerity measures on New York City. So they defund education, public health, transportation. They weaken municipal unions. They freeze the wages to city workers. They cut back the employment of city workers. They start charging tuition at the schools that had previously been publicly funded. They even figure out how to get the city unions to invest their pension funds in the city. So the way Harvey talks about this is all about wealth redistribution. You take the value that was placed into the population and you suck it up into the bankers. What is it that they demanded of the city? Supposedly a good business climate. And especially what they wanted to do was use public resources to build infrastructures, not which were going to be good for the people. They let the subways go to hell. They let the schools go to hell. But they built up the communications infrastructure because this was necessary, especially for global banking. Subsidies for corporations, tax incentives for corporations. This is all part of like building a good business environment. They turn New York City into a tourist attraction. This is the I Love New York motto starts here. And they rebuild New York City around financial activities, legal services, media, and diversified consumerism, which goes along with gentrification. And control over the city is completely removed from previously existent democratic processes. It's all happening behind closed doors, and the people having a whole lot of say behind those doors are the experts from the financial institutions. Okay. Let's see. 1978. Here's a good example of what happens with neoliberalism. Pharmaceutical companies had long been funded by the National Institute of Health. In 1978, all the products that had been generated on the basis of those public funds were turned into privatized patents. And so on the basis of public dollars, intellectual property was generated for corporations. And on the basis of that intellectual property, which is just an abstract, fancy-sounding way of saying they control the medicine and nobody else can have it, even if it would save their lives. On the basis of that, that's how we get the massive pharmaceutical industry that we now have today. Okay, 1979, all this same stuff is happening in England, especially around London with Margaret Thatcher. She's encouraging entrepreneurship. She wants to create a favorable business climate. She wants to induce foreign investment. This is around the same time that Thatcher like utters the famous phrase, you know, there is no such thing as society, because she wants to break down every last aspect of society. In the 1980s, we have business operating as a unified class to challenge consumer protections, labor protections, taxation, regulations of all sorts, environmental, labor, speculation, etc. Backing off antitrust laws. Then we get Reagan in the 1980s, who takes the National Labor Relations Board, which is supposed to exist in order to make sure that companies deal justly with their legitimate collective bargaining unions. Instead, that's used to attack labor. Tax code is revised. Importantly, the PATCO strike in 1981, Reagan fires nearly 12,000 air traffic controllers and prevents them from working in the industry for life. So this is like a moment at which, like, okay, you had your time. Labor power existed in the 20s, 30s, and then in a different form, in a big way, but a more bureaucratized and co-opted form in the 1940s to the 1960s. But by the 1980s, it's on its last legs. And then we have in Mexico, 1982, 1984, the first like clear instance of structural adjustment and, well, the first usage of that term probably. Let's see, by the 1990s, neoliberal policy is stabilized with Clinton and Blair as the Washington Consensus. And by the 1990s, you've got these elites, this ever-shrinking pool of ultra-elites who are themselves multinational. And they claim to be opposed to state interference and regulation, but the truth is that they utilize state apparatuses to their liking in multiple places. So the example Harvey gives is Rupert Murdoch, who comes from Australia, then goes to the UK, and then has dual citizenship between the UK and the US. He uses the state apparatuses to his liking. At this point, multinational capital is bigger and more powerful than nation states, and it utilizes nation states in certain ways. Nominally, the neoliberal ideology has it that corporate power and good Christians and good Americans are all opposed to a state that is too big. But in the background, really, the state as a repressive apparatus is always growing. The military-industrial complex is always growing. The surveillance system is always growing. The secret police are always growing as means of protecting the class privilege of these ever-shrinking, ever more powerful interests. So they use the state. and then, like, maybe the last one here, take what happened in Iraq in 2003. This is more like Chile, right? It's not about insinuating neoliberalism. It's about imposing a free market model ultra, ultra violently. So like supposedly we exported freedom to Iraq, right? What we really exported was this dullard kind of incompetent stooge named Paul Bremer, who goes over to Iraq and just does exactly what his corporate masters, especially Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and Halliburton, tell him to do, and he privatizes all public enterprises. He sets up a constitution for the Iraqi people, which then they set up a puppet regime which approves that constitution and makes it the law for Iraq, in which all public enterprises are privatized, all public services, all manufacturing, all transport, all finance, all construction. It's totally legal for foreign firms to own Iraqi businesses. It's totally legal for those foreign countries to just run off with all their profits that they get from exploiting Iraqi resources, that they get from exploiting Iraqi labor. the banks are opened to foreign controls. So this is to say that the banks become a wing, an aspect, a moment of the global banks, which are like always moving more and more towards monopoly. They do away with all trade barriers. So this is the order that we are living in. We're up to 2003, 2005 now. This is the same world we're living in. I haven't given you an analysis of everything that's happened. I won't say that there are no complexities. There are tons. But there also exists a general trend which admits of analysis and which can be understood. And the important thing to recognize about it is that your belief in the neoliberal interpretation of so-called American values is a part of the project by which you yourself, your people, and the people of the rest of the world are increasingly dispossessed from land, air, water, other people, education, and the truth. So I would urge you to rethink all that shit. Nurture a taste for the curiosity for contexts, for historical backdrops. And please understand that the values that you have are not just your values. There's no such thing. We've all gotten our values from somewhere. And where we've gotten them from is the physical space that we're always inhabiting. And the institutional discourses and activities that happen within those spaces. And realize further that those spaces are not neutral. They themselves are battlegrounds where one and another idea is struggling for supremacy. But it's not ultimately just a struggle of ideas. The struggle of ideas is a part of, but also a mask for, a struggle at a much deeper and physical and material and violent level. And that is a struggle for the control over resources, over your body and its labor, over territory, over control over the decision-making of the world, control over how the economy and how political structures and how governance are going to go, and whether the oceans can be completely destroyed, and whether Standing Rock, the Standing Rock Sioux territory can be completely despoiled, and whether your children are going to be allowed to know the truth of their own history. All these things are part of, they're all in contest. You are in the midst of a battle, and the battle is hyper-violent, even though you don't recognize it. As you watch your violent TV and you feel perhaps that what's happening on the violent TV is just spectacle, and so you have this sort of numbed, like, consent, realize that this shit is ultra-violent. It's ultra-violent, and it's a struggle. I don't think I'm engaging in hyperbole. It's a struggle which ultimately bears upon the fate of the human species. Now, I'm not suggesting that you little individual person can fix all this, but you can start. You can at least try to not be that complicit. And the first way to not be that complicit is to challenge the ideas that you've been given, to challenge the values that you've been given. Don't just think that freedom and the free market are the same thing. Don't just think that, like, you know, individualism is what Bill Gates is all about. That's not true. Don't just think that that what we've got, because it's called as democracy, is democracy. It's not. But you might think, wait, freedom still matters. What could I do to really be more free? What could we do? What changes in our real world would lead to more freedom? You could think, okay, independence and individualism really are important. And the first thing that implies is that I cannot just accept these values from outside. You can think, like, okay, democracy might actually be a legit thing, might be a desirable thing. If we're all, like, rational and free beings, or at least we have that capacity, then doesn't it seem like, and if equality is important, doesn't it seem like democracy is the only way to go? Oh, wait, but we don't have it. What would we have to do in order to establish it? And lastly, because this is my last moment of lecture here for the semester, I would urge you to rethink that super deep ideology that has been given to you which originated with bourgeois culture itself, apparently, in the 1600s in England, and then in Puritan culture in the colonies on the North American continent in the 1700s, and then was distributed by business people and then by big industrialists in the 1800s, especially Carnegie, and which has been taken over again under the heading especially of entrepreneurialism. You're all supposed to be entrepreneurs these days, right? Which means that you are all supposed to be striving for success. Well, please, if you've learned anything from this class, if this class has made you think, then please, please think about your orienting your life towards success and take control of that idea. And I don't just mean realize, you know, success for you could mean, you know, embracing a puppy every day. I don't want the cliche substitute there that you all already had in your back pocket when you showed up. I mean, no. Let's like radically revalue everything for ourselves. It is your responsibility to choose what really matters. And maybe what matters is not ascending in terms of class, because you're barely ever going to ascend, by the way. You're involved in a process where everybody is getting more and more precarious. Everybody is getting more and more subjugated, except for 1,000 people, 800 people, 300 people. That is the trend in which we're involved. And those that structure is more and more heavily armed. You know, if you just keep on like trying to do your best at work, that's what they want. You know, like that's what will continue that system. I urge you to reject the value of success altogether and think about what some other values might be. You know, if success is supposed to be the goal of life, that is an individualistic goal. Ultimately, I think it's a goal that makes you subject to others, namely to bosses, for the entirety of your life. What might you put in place of success? What about solidarity? What about freedom? What about democracy? What about real individualism? You know, those are things worth valuing if you can figure out the way in which they still have a meaning. But if you don't figure that out, even your own thinking is going to be doing the will of powers which exploit you and are ultimately destroying the world.